be out of after Mashiach comes, only Purim remains.
Well, that statement is not necessarily a literal statement. There's a lot of
just in general.
Well, because Purim celebrates God's presence in the ordinary process of life. I can't really give a short answer.
Because maybe other cemeteries will always be there.
Yeah, just a few comments. We're about hopefully to begin the book of Shmuel. As most of you know, the concept of Shmuel Aleph and Shmuel Bet, Shmuel 1, Shmuel 2, Malachim Aleph, Malachim Bet, Chronicles, Divrei HaYamim Aleph, Divrei HaYamim Bet, is not a Jewish division. In fact, according to the official list of canonized books in the Talmud, there is only one book of Shmuel, and there's only one book of Malachim, so the division of 1 and 2 is not a significant division. It was introduced by the Christians and later in the printing and the like. So we do have a single book called the Book of Shmuel. The truth of the matter is that Shmuel dies relatively early in the book. So the truth of the matter is Shmuel dies by the 10th chapter of the first book of Shmuel, and therefore he's not around for around 2/3 or more of the book. So obviously he is not the author of the book, at least anything that occurred after his death. Nevertheless, it is still called, in fact, the book of Shmuel the prophet is the author of the book of Judges and the story of Ruth. So in fact, if we call the book of Shmuel, it is not because he is the author, or even that it's mainly about him, because it is not, but simply because he is the character with whom the book begins. So therefore it was called Shmuel. It essentially spans four generations of leadership. It starts with a leader who is Eli, the Kohen Gadol. And Eli is the last Shofet. He's actually the last of the judges, although he is not mentioned in the book of Judges. It is followed by the prophet Shmuel, who is a leader. We'll discuss how many years. Shmuel, of course, is followed by the very first monarch, which is Shaul HaMelech. And Shaul HaMelech is then followed by David, that established the Davidic monarchy, the Davidic dynasty, which eventually culminates even in the coming of the Mashiach. Essentially, there are 55 chapters in Shmuel Aleph and Bet. Almost 40 of them, like 39 and a half, are about David HaMelech. So if we had to pick what is the book of Shmuel about, it is essentially the biography of King David, beginning with him as a youth, as a shepherd, his anointing by Shmuel, his visiting his brothers, David and Goliath, the eventual story of his various struggles against Shaul, although Shaul was his father-in-law, as we will see, and eventually becoming king, and in Shmuel Bet, the various problems that David has with his own children, Avshalom and the like. So this really is the biography of David HaMelech. That is really what the book of Shmuel is about. And it's amazing, if you consider in the book of Kings, for example, where many malachim, just like the Shoftim, may have, you know, three lines about them and the like, the amount of detail that is devoted to David HaMelech is indeed without parallel to any biblical character in the entire Tanakh, including Moshe Rabbeinu. Now, Moshe Rabbeinu, of course, figures prominently in 4 out of the 5 books of the Chumash, but we know relatively little about the biography of Moshe Rabbeinu. In other words, we know what he said and what he taught, but the events that occur are not viewed as events that occur to Moshe. The events in the Chumash are events that occur to the Jewish people as a whole. The Torah is written from the vantage point of what happens to the Jewish nation. By contrast, the book of Shmuel is pure biography, in the sense that everything that happens is focused into through the character of David HaMelech himself. Now, a few words about chronology. How many years does the book of Shmuel cover? In other words, it begins with Eli being the Shofet, and it ends at the very end of King David's life. Now, not quite, because if you carry it over to the book of Kings, at the very beginning of the book of Malachim, David dies. But essentially, Shmuel brings us almost to the end of David HaMelech's life. Well, we know the following. These are the numbers that were given in the book, and you'll see why there's some problems how to figure out all these numbers. We are told that Eli was a Shofet for 40 years. We are told that. We are later told that Shaul was a king for only 2 years. course, what we're not told is how many years was Shmuel in a position of leadership, right? That's a big unknown. But we do know Eli 40, Shaul 2, and David HaMelech's reign, we have a very, very clear number. David was a king for 40 years, and his 40-year reign is divided into two sections, and that is the first 7 years after Shaul's death. There essentially was a state of civil war between the Shaul people and the David people, and therefore David was only king over the tribe of Yehudah and people who followed him in Hebron, and his capital was Hebron. After 7 years, David conquered Jerusalem, and for 33 years he established a malchut on the Jewish nation, which was centered in Jerusalem. In fact, the so-called date, although it's not an accurate date, when they celebrated the 3,000th anniversary of Jerusalem, that supposedly was 3,000 years from the date that David had conquered Jerusalem and established the central monarchy. We are also told that at the end of the book of Shmuel, that Avshalom's rebellion against his father occurred in the 40th year. Now, it doesn't say the 40th year of what, but if you assume, as seems to be the simplest meaning, it was the 40th year of David's reign, that raises a lot of problems, because when we get to it, you'll see that David was quite active, basically. David kind of left Jerusalem and he had his own people, which connote that David in the last year of his reign was still vigorous and involved, and yet in the book of Kings we see a very different story. So there's a problem exactly what was David's state of health in his 40th year. But be it as it may, with all of these little pieces of bits and pieces of information, there are two main chronological problems. Chronological problem number one is, what is the length of Shmuel's life and his judgeship? That is not given in the book. Number two, it is very difficult to fit all of the events of Shaul's reign in that little span of 2 years. We're going to see there's a whole bunch of stuff that happened, and it's hard to imagine that everything happened within that span. There is a third chronological problem, and this emerges from a narrative in the book of Shoftim. And that is, remember we discussed last week, the Shofet, whose name was Yiftach, right? Yiftach is the infamous Shofet, who started off life as a juvenile delinquent and a gang leader. Basically says he assembled unto himself empty, you know, violent people. And eventually, he was elevated to leadership because they needed that style to combat the Ammonites. And of course, the infamous story of Yiftach is his vow that the first thing that I see when I come home, I shall bring as a korban to God. And the first thing that he saw was his daughter. We discussed last week whether that meant she was actually, God forbid, brought as a human sacrifice, or whether the concept was that she was consecrated to God as a nun, as a hermit in isolation. Like the Rabbanan, for example, does not see it possible that there would have actually have been an act of murder.
Same thing, there's a Greek mythology about exactly like Yiftach.
Yiftach, okay. These stories often do have parallels.
You think they happen to each other?
Well, there are parallels. I mean, there are many aspects of ancient wisdom do find their way in many, many cultures. That is true. But there's an aspect of Yiftach that actually I did not discuss with you, but it's very relevant in the chronology of Shmuel. And that is, remember, in Yiftach's time, the enemy that is harassing the Jewish nation is the nation of Ammon, the Ammonites. Now remember, the Ammonites live on the east bank of the Jordan, and the Ammonites are descended from Lot. Remember when Lot committed incest with his two daughters? One daughter named her son Moab from my father, and those are the Moabites. And the other named her son Ammon from my nation, and they became the Ammonites. And the Moabites and the Ammonites were not usually very friendly to the Jewish people. I mean, Ruth, of course, is a notable exception, and of course, David comes from Ruth. But the Ammonites were harassing us, burning. If you remember, it describes the fact in Yiftach's time that people were very poor because whatever they would harvest would either be seized by the Ammonite gangs or it would be burnt. And Yiftach's whole call to leadership was he was threshing grain and trying to hide it away, and he was called. Anyway, Yiftach, before he engages in battle with the Ammonites, he sends them a message. And it's a very interesting message. It's a message of history in which he documents the fact that how come the Ammonites are causing all this trouble, and he talks about the fact that 300 years ago, we have crossed, we crossed the Yarden River, and we have been in this land for 300 years, and you have never raised any question about our right to ownership. Why are you raising the question now? In other words, he was essentially saying that we have been here 300 years, and all of a sudden you're claiming that it's not our land. That argument, which has, of course, modern parallels as well. Now, here is the problem. So we are told, now this is a bit of an intricate cheshbon that you have to sit down and work out, but I'll just state the problem as the commentaries tell us. So, from crossing of the Jordan until Yiftach, and we don't know what year exactly he said this, but until Yiftach is 300 years. That's date number one. Now, in the Book of Kings, when King Solomon built the temple, we are given an extremely important date that is the basis of many, many biblical chronology. That is, the temple was built 480 years after the Jews left Egypt, in the fourth year of Solomon's reign. This is a date that is recorded. Now, 480 years from Yetziat Mitzrayim would be 440 years from the time they entered the land. Okay, so let's follow this again. Meaning to say, the temple was built in the fourth year of Solomon's reign, 440 years from the time they crossed the Yarden. Now let's work backwards. 4 years of Solomon and 40 years of David adds up to 44 years. In other words, basically we want to figure out exactly how much time elapsed, let's say, between Yiftach's proclamation and the building of the Beis HaMikdash. Well, we know. If crossing the Yarden to Yiftach was 300, and crossing the Yarden to the temple is 440, you have only 140 years between Yiftach and the fourth year of Shlomo HaMelech. 140 years. Right? Everyone understands how you get 140 years. Because 440 is from Yarden to the Binyan Beis HaMikdash. 300 years is from Yarden to Yiftach. That gives you a period of 140 years. Now, if we look at the remaining Shoftim after Yiftach, in other words, you can see how you can narrow this down. All right, so 140 years from Yiftach to the building of the Beis HaMikdash. Now, here is the thing. If you add Shimshon, which was 20 years, Shimshon is the Shofet after Yiftach, 20 years of Shimshon, 40 years of Eli, which is 60 years, and 23 years of the various other assorted Shoftim. So 40, 20, and 23 gives you, what, 103. I'm sorry, did I add?
83.
I'm sorry, 83, yeah. Well, because Eli was a Shofet for 40 years. Shimshon was a Shofet for 20 years, that's 60 years. And then if you add all the other small judges, you get a period of 23 years. So that's what, that's 83 years. So again, what have we shown? So where does that bring us? That means, okay, and then you have to take away, okay, in other words, again, the number that we come up with, get these numbers you can fly out of your head, the number you come up with is this. Once again, we have 140 years from Yiftach to the fourth year of Shlomo HaMelech. Because that's the building of the temple. 140 years. Now, if we want to position how many years we have for Shmuel, we do the following. Take away the 4 years of Shlomo and the 40 years of David. So now we can restate our calculus. That's 44 years. So 140 minus 44 gives you 96 years. Now we have 96 years from Yiftach to the beginning of David's reign. Right? 96 years from Yiftach to the beginning of David's reign. Now in those 96 years, you have 40 years of Eli, 20 years of Shimshon, and 23 years of the other Shoftim. So subtract from 96, 83, and that gives you a total of only 13 years. And indeed, this is the chronology of Seder Olam. That Seder Olam, which is the chronicle from the time of the Mishnah, that sets out biblical chronology, it makes the following points. That Shmuel died at the age of 52. Shmuel died very relatively young. And Shmuel was a Shofet for the last 13 years of his life. Of course, you still have a problem because we have 2 years of Shaul, but Shmuel effectively overlapped with Shaul. Shmuel died a very short time before Shaul, and therefore the 2 years of Shaul are included in the last 2 years of Shmuel's reign. So you see now, this is a complicated cheshbon, but basically if you go through these numbers, assuming that they are accurate as recorded in Tanakh, you know, people always raise questions about the other, but going with the numbers that we are given in the text, we have a leadership of Shmuel for only 13 years. Now, how do we know how old he was? That already is a bit more complicated, but we can figure this out the following. Let me just finish the chronology. According to rabbinic tradition, the book of Shmuel begins with Hannah encountering the Kohen Gadol and asking and praying for a child. According to tradition, that was the very day that Eli became a shofet. That was his first day as Kohen Gadol and shofet. Shmuel was born 1 year later. So that means to say, Shmuel and Eli died, right? Eli died 39 years after that, because Eli was a shofet for 40 years. Therefore, Shmuel was 39 years old when Eli died, and with the 13 years, that brings him to 52. So he was a shofet for 13 years, okay? So this is the cheshbon. Now, once again, this still leaves you with the question that if Shaul's entire reign was only 2 years, how did all those different events happen? And essentially, the Barbanel is all different cheshbon. The Barbanel, I'll just give you his conclusion, because I don't want to work out alternative chronologies. They're a little difficult. But the Barbanel says, Shmuel was a judge for 20 years, and Saul was a king for 17 years, and the way all the numbers work out is when Yiftach said 300 years, he really meant only 268 years. He was just rounding it off to the nearest hundred, and then you get a whole bunch of extra years to play with. But basically, the rabbinal actually proves that Shmuel was a shofet for many more years. But the standard rabbinic tradition was that Shmuel was only a shofet for 12 or 13 years, and the last 2 years overlapped with Shaul. Sorry, one. Okay. You see, you're saying that we don't have to take out. It was Yitzchak's words as opposed to God's words, like it is in the Book of Kings. 480 number is the narrative voice of the prophet, right, in the Book of Kings, as opposed to Yitzchak. Yeah, it could very well be. And the Barbanel says that certainly Yitzchak is trying to establish the legitimacy of the Jewish presence. There might be a tendency to exaggerate and elaborate a little bit. Okay, so this is just a little bit of chronology. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on it, because the numbers get more and more complicated, but it is important to know that under the standard Seder Olam, Shmuel died at 52, and he was a shofet for 13 years. It's interesting that why did Shmuel die so young? It's an interesting point. It's really very, very scary. It comes up to the idea, which is something you find in many midrashim, of not being too precise in your prayer. But sometimes when you ask for something, God gives you exactly what you ask for, and then you're in trouble. Like, you know, the old Greek mythology, who was the king who touched King Midas? Yeah, King Midas. Whatever I want to touch will be gold. And when Hannah prayed for a child, she said the following: if I am given a child, I will give him to the service of God ad olam, for eternity. There's a little twist. The word olam in the Tanakh is used for the period of the Jubilee year. For example, it talks about slaves working ad olam forever, and that means they go free in the Jubilee. So in effect, she was saying, I consecrate him for 50 years of divine service. And she brought Shmuel to the temple when he was 2 years old. So in effect, her prayer ad olam kind of created that idea that he would only serve God for 50 years, and therefore the 52. But that is... there's a beautiful thought, the Ari says, a Kabbalistic thought, and this is very intriguing. Now, in the Haggadah, there's a passage in the Haggadah of Pesach. I'm sure you remember this, but this is towards the beginning when our minds are not yet clouded by strong drink. And that is the statement of Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah: behold, I am like a person of 70 years old, and I have not yet been able to convince people about reciting the Exodus at night until there was a drasha, an interpretation. So the Gemara comments, what does he mean to say, I am like a person of 70 years old? What is that phrase? So the Gemara actually gives us a story that Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah was appointed to be the Nasi, the head of the Sanhedrin, at a young age. He was only 18. But the responsibilities of leadership were so difficult that his beard turned prematurely gray. The Talmud recounts that God did this to him so people would think he was old and distinguished. But the other interpretation is it just made him age. You see this with presidents, right? Presidents always look so much older after they've been in the White House for a while. So maybe Martin Sheen, whatever. But anyway, the thing is, the Ari says the following idea. The Kabbalist, the Ari, had developed the whole idea of reincarnation. And he was able to identify, supposedly, which people were reincarnations of others. And he claimed that Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah was a reincarnation of the soul of Shmuel. Now, Shmuel left this world at the age of 52. And if Shmuel's soul was born into Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah, he was born with the soul of a 52-year-old man. When he was 18, therefore, he says, "Behold, I am like a person of 70, because at that age he was 70. This is what the Ariya says. But anyway, the be it as it may, this is the standard Seder HaOlam sequence, that Shaul was a king for 2 years. That is actually recorded. It is recorded, Shaul was a king for 2 years, but the Rabbanel fetches that, so to speak, to say that the event that is recorded occurred in the second year of his reign. It is not intended to give you the sum total of his reign. We'll look at that again. But Seder HaOlam says that indeed 2 years was the sum total of Shaul's reign, and the rest of the years are David, etc. Okay, so that's a little bit of background. Yeah. Sure. Well, Shmuel, of course, we were specifically given the reason for his name. Sure. Now, we don't have an explanation for every single person's name. Yeah. That's right. But for many of the names, so we certainly know. David, for example, comes from Yedid, which is beloved one. Even a doe means a beloved dog. We believe that David was beloved by God.
Why?
David is beloved by God. Why was he beloved by God? Well, God saw him, David. Well, part of the greatness of Tanakh generally is that people's faults are not covered up. We are told that David sins, and in fact, I was going to save it for later, but let me anticipate a little bit now. You know, one of the meta themes of the Book of Shmuel is to examine the different modes of leadership. For example, Shaul is made king on a short-term basis, and Shaul makes a mistake. Shaul's primary mistake was he was given the mission to kill the Amalekites, and he does not. He spares, he does actually kill Amalek, but he does spare the king of Amalek, and he spares the animals, and Shmuel goes over to him and says, "That's it, you're finished." And Shaul begged him, and it even says, Shmuel, actually a very, very touching scene, says Shmuel prayed for Shaul the entire night. Shmuel actually begged God to give Shaul a second chance. We don't realize that, but it's in the verse. That he cried to God all night that God should give Shaul a second chance. And God said no. And at that point, Shmuel becomes the enforcer. And Shmuel comes to him the next day and says, "You're out. God has given the kingdom to somebody better than you." Now, Shaul hung on, right? Shaul did not cease being king until he died. But from that day forward, he knew that his days were measured, and of course that's when his persecutions against David began in earnest. Because, and of course, imagine the frustration of Shaul's own son, his closest friend, is David, and how that rankles and how that hurts, and how he feels that his own son is betraying him. Okay, we'll discuss that. And the issue of mental illness is always an issue. Exactly, what is the clinical diagnosis of Shaul? This is something that has intrigued doctors and psychiatrists for hundreds and hundreds of years, but at least in the Book of Shmuel, it is described as a profound spiritual malaise, the sense that the Spirit of God has left it, that the creativity, the energy, the leadership, which God has given his choice king. Shaul is called the Mashiach Hashem. Remember, the word Mashiach, we say Messiah. Mashiach means to be anointed, because they would anoint kings with oil. Even non-Jewish kings are sometimes called in Tanakh the anointed one. Cyrus, the king of Persia, who gave permission to return to the land of Israel, is called the Mashiach Hashem, the anointed. So it doesn't necessarily refer to the final redeemer, Mashiach. Shaul is called Mashiach Hashem over and over again. And yet when he felt that the divine favor has left him, that put him in a profoundly depressed state. OK? can imagine that. One feels that all of the abilities have left. Now, Shaul is not given a second chance. Now, David HaMelech also commits many, many serious, well, not many, but a number of serious avos that are described. The most infamous or the most outstanding is David's affair with Bathsheba. Now, it is true that the Talmud tells us that it was not exactly as it appeared in the narrative. It seems to be described as a combination of adultery with a married woman, and then he sends her husband off to be killed in battle so he could marry her. The Gemara tells us anybody who says King David actually committed adultery is making a mistake, because technically, according to the halakha, soldiers who would go off to battle would give their wives divorces, so in case they're missing in action. So technically, she was not married, but still, that doesn't mean it wasn't a sin. The idea was, when the husband comes back, they would be reunited. So it's a spiritual form of adultery. And so the question is, David suffered tremendously. Absalom, all of the different things that happened were a punishment for this sin. But the one thing that was never taken away from him was the monarchy, the malchut, and the idea of passing it down to his children, and the idea that even in Galut, the eventual Mashiach will be descended from David. So the commentaries do ask the question, what is it with David that he keeps on getting second chances, and Shaul does not get a second chance? Yeah, there are a number of answers, but one of the answers that is given is, how do they respond when they are confronted by God with evidence of their guilt? If you remember that this will be the Haftarah before Purim, Parshat Zachar is this Haftarah. So if you remember, when Shmuel confronts Shaul and says, why did you not carry out the word of God? Shaul's first response is denial. He says, sure. He points to what he did. Sure, I did this and this and this and this. And Shmuel says, what is the voice of the sheep that I hear bleeding? You can't deny it. So his next stage is passing the blame to others. He says, well, you know, I wanted to do it, but they didn't let me. I was afraid of the people. They really wanted it, so I gave in to them. Meaning, Shaul is a, and he does this a few times, Shaul is a combination of denial and a failure to assume responsibility. David is confronted when he takes Bathsheba and he sends Uriah the Hittite, Uriah the Hitti, who gets killed in war. So David did not kill him directly, but as the prophet says, you killed him with the Ammonite sword. Maybe the Ammonites killed him, but you were the one that was wielding that sword. And Natan the prophet, who by the way is considered to be the author of the rest of the book of Shmuel, after Shmuel rather dies, Natan HaNavi, gives David a very famous parable about the man that has the rich man and the poor man, and the rich man has flocks and flocks of animals, and the poor man has one little sheep, and it's a little bit of an ad mashal in many ways, because the pasuk describes almost a marital relationship with the sheep, kind of affectionate. He feeds the sheep and he eats at the same table and everything else. And he says, and the rich man takes the little sheep for his own. What shall be done with such a person? And David says, such a wretched person deserves to die. And Natan points to David and says, you, Atayish, you are that man. And at that point, the Navi tells us that David only responded with one word, Chatasim, I have sinned. There is no explanation. There is no excuse. There is no blaming anyone else for the situation. After all, he could have blamed Bathsheba. Remember what did Adam HaRishon say? What does Adam say? When he said, this woman that you gave me, you know, right? He could have said, Bathsheba's bathing, or whatever, he sees her bathing without clothes. I mean, he could have said, you know, she provoked me into this. But he doesn't. He doesn't blame anyone else. And the commentaries tell us a very important idea, that the concept of a leader is not that a leader is without sin. Leaders can have faults. People can make mistakes. People can be very, very serious if they want, and God will call them for it. There will be accountability. But the quality of leadership is the ability to admit one's mistakes, to take responsibility for one's shortcomings, and then to move on. This is actually very, very relevant to political situations. This is what you see. What you see is, it is not so much the aveira that a person does that disqualifies them, but how they own up to the responsibility after the fact. Well, I would say, I don't have to say not based on that idea. I think he fails both prongs of the test. But be it as well, I don't want to, you know, directly get into the personality issues. You can draw your own conclusions on it. But it does tell us, and again, the prototype for this, by the way, goes back to the ancestor of David HaMelech, and that is none other than Yehuda, right? Yehuda is the ancestor of David HaMelech, and it's the exact same thing. When he committed promiscuous relations with his daughter-in-law, not knowing it was his daughter, but he thought it was a prostitute, so it doesn't make it that much better. And she's about to be burned at the stake because she committed adultery. It's not her husband is dead. What adultery did she commit? But be it as the way, she's going to be burned at the stake. And she refuses to disclose the man she was with because that would humiliate someone probably. And the Gemara says, better to throw yourself in a furnace of fire before you publicly humiliate someone, as we see from Tamar. But what she did do is she sent her father-in-law a very subtle hint that I was with the man that gave me this ring and this staff, because Yehuda had left with the prophets. I guess prostitutes didn't take checks in those days. She required a deposit for full payment. And she says, the man that gave me this. And Yehuda got up and said, I am the person, said Kavli Meni, she is more righteous than me. That quality of leadership, meaning even when you fail, you get up and you acknowledge, is something that is very, very meaningful. In fact, it's brought up that this is actually one of the reasons why Malchut was given to Yehuda and then David, rather than Yosef. Because look at Yosef. Yosef, in many ways, was also suitable for royalty. Number one, he was royalty in Egypt. Number two, he sustained his people and the whole Egyptian nation as well. But it's interesting. When Yosef was faced with a sexual temptation, Potiphar's wife, he just said no. He had the inner strength not to succumb to temptation. And it's almost as if the leadership should be given to people with flaws who can rise above it and not be given to paragons of perfection. Mm-hmm. Because a concept of someone who is too perfect is not a meaningful role model for people, because we fail, we make mistakes, and we need people who teach us that you can rise above your mistakes and you can go on. Again, it's a difficult idea, and of course,
after you make a mistake, first you enjoy the mistake, and then you can rise above.
Well, that's the nature. That's the nature of the mistakes. But the thing is this. Well, I mean, that was
rising above it beforehand.
Yeah, but the idea is. Even in the genre, you know, in Jewish writing, there is a genre, it's an English word, G-E-N-R-E, a genre of literature that involves biographies of great rabbis. So if you've seen it, Moshe Feinstein, they're biographies of great rabbis. And in the biographies of great rabbis, they almost have a very standardized format. It talks about how brilliant they were as children. Something like, you know, when they were 4 years old, so they memorized the Talmud, you know, things like that. And they're kind of all the same, because all of these great rabbis, like, had phenomenal achievements. And a very, very perceptive person who's also a very great rabbi, Rabbi Hittner, once remarked that this genre of literature is not really as helpful to people in their own spiritual quest as one might assume, because they create paragons of perfection. And we read that, and we say, you know, that's never going to be me. That's not going to be my kids. But he says one of the things that is underrepresented in these biographies are the struggles and failures that great people went through on their way to becoming great. Because the truth of the matter is, we can learn much more from the mistakes that great people make and how they rise above them and go on than we can from an unbroken record of perfection and accomplishment. He gave an example. Let's take the Chafetz Chaim. The Chafetz Chaim is well known to us as a person, and tzaddik in so many ways, but a person who never spoke Lashon Hara about anybody. Right? He even trained himself to fall asleep. If he began gossiping when he was older, if it gets easier, he would just fall asleep. However,
wake up, right?
Well, there is, just to tell you a little Lashon Hara about a famous political daughter, Alice Roosevelt, Longworth, Teddy Roosevelt's daughter, lived for many, many years after the father's presidency, and she became one of the great hostesses of Washington. And even when she was not able to walk that well, she used to love having parties. So she made a cushion on her couch that said, "If you don't have anything good to say, come sit next to me." some people do enjoy the Lashon Hara. But the point is, what was the Chafetz Chaim like at 15? You know, we don't have the information. At 16, at 20, you know, did he have these difficulties? How did he surmount them? What were his strategies? And Refugio pointed out, you can learn a lot more from how someone deals with mistakes or adversity or failure than you can from unbroken perfection. And that's one of the reasons why the Tanakh does not pull punches in terms of flaws and mistakes and failings, because this is a book in which we're supposed to learn that in human life there's going to be failure. In spiritual life, there are going to be avodah, there are going to be mistakes that we make. But then we have to be able to know to pick ourselves up and go on again. And that's really the idea, that Shaul made a mistake and didn't acknowledge. No mistake? Shaul made no mistake?
If God is wrong, then it has to be totally wrong. He did a remarkable thing.
Well, I'll tell you this. Shaul is like a neutron bomb. He killed all the people except one. He saved the sheep. So I'm not going to say that Shaul was motivated out of compassion. Shaul did not spare 99.9% of Amalek. He spared one person and all of the sheep. So if you have a question with Amalek, and I'm not saying it's not a question. That's not true. He said he killed everybody except Amalek. That's what he said. I'm sorry, except the king of Amalek. So, you know, these are good questions. I mean, how do we understand Amalek is an interesting question, but certainly I don't think you could put Shaul, you cannot chuck up the motivation out of compassion, because unless you're going to say compassion for a king, a fellow ruler, which is not a particularly great value.
Maybe that was the point, and he killed the king and he didn't spare the children.
Yeah, I mean, he didn't kill the king, but he killed the children.
Yeah.
Well, let me check. Let me just be sure. Maybe. Well, let me check. Let me check it out. Let me check it right now. The Let me check if you're correct. I'm looking again. I'm just looking at chapter 15. Verse 8. And it is that Shaul did not spare the women and the children. Shaul spared the animals and the king. So, you know, it's hard to look at it as a totally compassionate response. Yeah.
But don't you think that there's also value in having a leader who, in his role as leader, is pretty close to... just being human, you're going to have flaws.
Right.
If I see Yosef saying no to Mrs. Potiphar, then when I see a piece of cheesecake in front of me, I know I can just say no.
Right. No, it's very true. I mean, obviously, leaders are supposed to be role models, too. That's obviously the case. And in fact, keep in mind that the tribe of Yosef were the kings of the Ten Kingdom, although they were hardly paragons of virtue in that capacity. But they, in fact, did have a malchut of the Aseret HaShvatim, because all of the kings of the ten tribes were from the tribe of Ephraim. So they did have that malchut, and also before Mashiach, the son of David, there is the Mashiach, the son of Yosef. So there is that precursor as well. But there seems to be kind of a split role, meaning you had the king that was the political leader, and then you had the Navi, the prophet, like Shmuel. So Shmuel was the check, was the one that was the spiritual conscience of the monarchy, and it was that kind of combination. And also the Gemara tells us another thing, a sociological idea, that it's important for a king to be humble. And humility comes when you have an awareness of your proneness for mistakes. A person that is too perfect, or perfect, and combine it with the power of a monarch, could lead to a certain arrogance over people, and an abuse of power. So God wanted, as it were, imperfect people to have this political power. Now, of course, you could also, well, it doesn't work the opposite. If you're imperfect, aren't you more prone to be an abuser? Because a perfect person would know, you know, know that power comes from God. But still, there was this kind of this balance of keeping people humble. Again, it's an interesting idea, but ultimately a very, very deep idea as well.
So let's get 911 then.
Come on, 911.
Yeah.
I have to apologize for the interruption. God willing, should have a refuah shleima. I do appreciate that people notice. Sometimes when I see people nodding off, I don't always make the assumptions that perhaps one should make. So it was very good that you were very observant.
Nobody thought that you would be
That's right, Rabbi.
We were just talking about
Yeah. So God willing, you should have a refuah shleima. Okay. going back now, right, so basically, this issue about the ideal Jewish leader is a very, very intriguing and interesting issue. And again, we will come back to it again when we actually get to the chapters about Shaul and David and the like. And of course, this also raises the problem. There are other problems as well. Remember, in the Chumash, at the end of the book of Bereishit, when Yaakov is on his deathbed, and Yaakov is giving a blessing to each of the tribes. So what is the blessing that Yaakov gives to Yehuda? He says, Lo Yasur Shevet Mi Yehuda. The scepter of royal authority shall never depart from the tribe of Yehuda. Meaning, even before David was born, it was decreed in Yaakov's blessing that Malchut should belong to Yehuda. And that, of course, raises the question, well, what tribe was Shaul from? Binyamin. So why was there this Binyaminite monarchy if Malchut belongs to Yehuda? And what are you going to answer? Shaul was only meant to be temporary, but the implication is, had Shaul not sinned, the permanent monarchy could have gone from them. Now, I once surmised, I never saw this theory anywhere, that the reason why Shaul was a melech, there was a Malchut from the tribe of Binyamin, is somewhat similar to why Lincoln chose Andrew Johnson for his vice president in the second term. If you know remember the history, Andrew Johnson was from Tennessee, and Tennessee had actually been a rebel state in the Confederacy, and Lincoln felt that a way to show that the Confederate states can be welcomed back into the Union was by bringing a former Confederate into the government. Now, if you remember, a few years before, we had the incident of Pilegesh B'Giva, a concubine in Giva, which resulted in a massive civil war in which the tribe of Binyamin was almost totally decimated, almost totally destroyed. Perhaps God wanted to communicate the idea that the tribe of Binyamin is a full-fledged partner to the Jewish people by creating that Malchut. Perhaps it's a similar type of conciliatory gesture. But still, that doesn't answer the question. Well, yes, but how could we say if Shaul hadn't sinned, the Malchut would have remained in him? It wouldn't it have to go over to somebody from the tribe of Yehuda? So what are you going to say? Well, God knew he was going to sin. But of course, God knew. But you have to build into the calculation at least a theoretical possibility that Malchut could have remained there had there not been a sin, even though God knew that that wouldn't be the case. So again, we'll discuss this. Again, these are issues that we'll actually get to when we get to the Prakim, but those are the very intriguing issues. And yet another issue, kind of just front-loading the questions that we're going to be discussing, is, well, gee, the Torah says that when the Jewish people come to the land of Israel, they should have a melech. Som tasim alecha melech. Som tasim alecha melech. This is in the Torah as a commandment. And yet, number one, the Jews have been in Israel for more than 300 years without a king, and nobody complained. And when they finally ask for a king, Shmuel says, oh, you are rebelling against God because God should be your king. But the Torah says they're supposed to ask for it. Right? So, is it good? Is it bad? And how do you understand that issue? Right? So there are a lot of different issues. Whether Shmuel is an anti-monarchist, or is he a pro-monarchist? Now remember, in a sense, there's a contradiction. There's almost a split personality here, because the book of Judges, I think we developed the idea that the book of Judges, with its portrayal of lawlessness and anarchy, could be understood as a justification why there needed to be a central authority. Ish kala yashar b'yeinav, because everybody was doing what they wanted. So in effect, it is a brief in favor of the monarchy. And yet, according to rabbinic tradition, who was the author of that brief? None other than the prophet Shmuel. And yet, Shmuel's own tendencies, as reflected in his response, was God should be your king. Right? So there seems to be, Shmuel almost appears to be of two minds on this matter. And apparently Shmuel's thought is, yes, ideally God should be your king, but pragmatically that doesn't work. Meaning Shmuel can bemoan the failures of humanity that doesn't allow them to be submissive to the will of God alone. And therefore he says it's an evil thing that you need a king, but it might be a necessary evil thing. So the book of Shoftim is the necessity for the monarchy. In the book of Shmuel, he expresses the regret that there is such a necessity, that an idealized form of human nature is that we shouldn't have to have human rulers over us telling us what to do. The Torah should be enough. What was the story? Tell a story.
Yeah, say something.
This is in the book of Devarim, the book of Deuteronomy. in Parshat Shoftim, chapter 18. Solm Tasim Alecha Melech. Now, what's interesting, there's a story about there's a famous Hasidic Rebbe, the Kutzker Rebbe. Maybe many of you have heard of him. He's one of the most enigmatic, interesting Hasidic leaders of the 19th century. The last 40 years of his life, he became a hermit. He closeted himself up into a room, and he would not see anybody. He would come out once a year to search for chametz. Then he would go back in, and he still had Hasidim who would learn outside of his door and daven outside of his door. And every once in a while, he would open the door and he would frighten them. He would yell something at them, yell some enigmatic thing to them about, you know, what do you think you're doing? You know, and then he would close himself up again. And of course, there are all sorts of legends as to why he became a hermit, ranging from all sorts of things, ranging from the desecrated Shabbat to other things. You know, very, 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 very unclear. And those who might know don't say exactly what happened. But in his younger years, when he was more active, so he had an open house. So he had hundreds of people coming into his house all the time. And things were missing. Silverware was missing. Candelabras were missing. And his shamash, his attendants, said to him, you know, why shouldn't people take things? The doors are open and nothing's put away. Why shouldn't they take things? And the Kutzker Rebbe came out. He was saying it to somebody. So the Kutzker Rebbe came out of his room and said, why shouldn't they take things? Because God says you don't steal. That's why you don't take things. What do you mean? Meaning, Kutzker Rebbe was saying exactly what Shmuel was saying. God is your king. What do you need policemen? What do you need law and order? What do you need government? God tells you to behave a certain way, you behave a certain way. That's the beautiful utopian vision. But Shmuel knows that utopian vision is not the world that we live in. So we can regret. Government is, in some ways, considered to be an evil. Government is an evil. But government is a necessary evil because of the imperfections. That's what Pirkei Avot says. You shall always pray for the peace of the governments, because without the fear of the government, each person would swallow everybody alive. Pirkei Avot says. And what government were they talking about? They were not talking about some benign, kind, proto-Semitic government. They were talking about the Roman government that was oppressive and anti-Semitic. And still, it created a certain stability in society that was considered to be essential. That's shalom. Of course, I think the Kutzker Rebbe, ironically, gives another interpretation. He says like this. He says, Have mitzpalel. He says he should pray for the peace of the kingdom. So he says the following. It's a Hasidic mistranslation. He says, you should pray when the government is at peace, because when they're not fighting some war out there, they're going to create a lot of trouble for you. So be sure to pray when things are peaceful. You know, that's when you should worry about it. Okay. But the point I want to make, though, is that the concept of Shoftim, which in many ways is a pro-monarchy call, and Shmuel, which has a strong anti-monarchist refrain, is simply the divergence between the ideal and the reality. The ideal is God should be the king. The reality is we need human authority. And Shmuel comes to recognize both of those ideas. Now, the beginning of the book of Shmuel...
But the monarchy never solved the problem.
That's correct. The monarchy itself didn't totally work. That's 100% correct. But in an ideal sense, again, it's still levels of ideal. The ideal of the ideal is people are self-motivated. The reality of the world is we need a leadership and a government to help protect the public. The real reality is that often that government fails in its own job as well. So the truth is you got to try to... We can't reach utopia, but I think we could try to reach the level in which a government does protect society and create a moral society. By the way, most commentaries, including Maimonides, do say appointing a king is a mitzvah in the Torah. Som tasim alecha melech is a mitzvah. However, the one exception to this is the commentary of Abarbanel. Abarbanel writes that monarchy is not a good thing. Any monarchy is not a good thing, because monarchs have absolute power and they tend to abuse it. And it's very interesting that the Abarbanel writes from a very autobiographical standpoint. Rav Yitzchak Abarbanel, as you know, was the finance minister for Ferdinand and Isabella at the time of the Spanish Inquisition and at the time of Columbus discovering America. In fact, he was the one that was instrumental in raising money for that. He was a brilliant financier as well as a great rabbinic scholar. And when the Jews were expelled, when they were given the choice of embracing Christianity or expulsion, he was given the choice. The only Jew in Spain was given the option of remaining a Jew, and he could remain in Spain because he was so essential. He was so essential. He, of course, refused the offer, and he left with everyone else, and he went to Portugal, and then he went to Italy. And he writes there that he knows firsthand the abuses of monarchies, their arrogance, their absolute power, their ability to trample on people because there are no consequences. And he was a great admirer of the Italian city-states. He writes this: Florence and Naples and Genoa and Venice, where there were elected representative leaders who had definite term limits. He actually calls for term limits, he says, because then they knew that any decision that they would make, they would be held accountable because somebody else would be ahead, and there would be a leader instead of them. So he actually embraces representative government and term limits as I'm saying. Right. That's correct. That's correct.
And I had only to read Megillat Esther, which I did yesterday. Megillat Esther, because he's the terrible king of the monarch. Yeah. I mean, a wife he had, but well, he's what he wanted to.
Yeah, but that's true. But the argument here is that a king that is subject to the rules of the Torah itself would rein him in. That's correct. But the Abarbanel points out that de facto, the history of monarchs is most of the monarchs were not righteous kings, even among the Jews. So he says, all in all, it's not necessarily a great system. But the Abarbanel is what we call a dat yachid. He really is a single view on this. And Maimonides disagreed. Maimonides, again, it's kind of a Neoplatonic idea. If you remember, Plato suggested that the ideal form of government were philosopher kings. And Maimonides describes the ideal Jewish king.
What was the Abarbanel? A doctor?
Abarbanel? No, Abarbanel was a finance minister.
Finance.
He was a...
Which
Maimonides had a much... Maimonides had a very good relationship. Again, I mean, I don't want to turn their halakhic positions into matters of, you know, I had a good king as an employer, you had a bad king. But certainly, I think there was an influence. I mean, there's no question that Maimonides' positive view of Islam came from his familiarity with Islam. Maimonides' opinion was Islam is a monotheistic religion and Christianity is a pagan religion. That's Maimonides' view. The truth is he had very little connection to Christianity, so, you know, your opinions get formed that way. And Maimonides, of course, was very, very close to the Sultan in Egypt. He had a personal position. So there are all sorts of... Well, Maimonides' problem was that the Trinity, the Trinity was essentially an idolatrous idea because it connoted multiplicity of divinity as well as corporeality, putting God in this form of a body. That's why I think there's a statement that came out recently by Jewish-Christian cooperation. It has Dabru Emet. It has a Hebrew name, Dabru Emet. Mm-hmm. Dabru Emet. It's an interfaith.
Speak the truth.
Speak the truth. It's an interfaith statement. And it's being criticized in a lot of circles.
The movement?
No, interfaith. There was an interfaith. Dabru Emet tried to create a common theological vocabulary by saying that Jews and Christians essentially believe in the same God, etc. And this has been very severely criticized because of ideas like the Trinity and the like. So some rabbi got up, I just read, and said, he doesn't want to call it Dabru Sheker, but we should at least say Dabru Chatsi Emet. Just speak half-truths, so don't call it Dabru Emet. Okay, but we'll go back to the monarchy issues as we go on, because obviously it's very, very central to the book. But the beginning of Shmuel is a very, very charming and beautiful story about the story of Shmuel's birth. And this story is actually read in the shul every year on Rosh Hashanah. It is the Haftorah on one of the days of Rosh Hashanah. And this is because, according to rabbinic tradition, although it's not recorded in the book, Chana conceived a child on Rosh Hashanah, that God blessed Chana with fertility on Rosh Hashanah. And therefore, Rosh Hashanah is a time in which we ask God to remember us for good. And therefore, we bring up the story of Chana. And it is the story of a couple, Elkanah, and a man, Elkanah, had two wives. In those days, polygamy was permitted. One's name was Chana, and the other name was Penina. And Penina had many children, and Chana had no children. And every year, he would bring up his family to bring a korban to God in Shiloh. Now, again, just to be sure we understand the geography here. Obviously, there was no temple built yet. The temple in Yerushalayim is not built until the days of Shlomo HaMelech. Not only that, but Yerushalayim as a city has not even been conquered yet. It is under the jurisdiction of the Yebusi. Of course, if you remember, though, we did explain that the Yebusi does not refer to the Yebusite nation, but rather Yebusi is a grandson of a Philistine king, Abimelech, and Avraham had made a treaty with Abimelech that he would not take away anything from them. So Avraham is kind of, or the Jews are kind of stuck by Avraham's commitment not to wage war until in Yerushalayim until Abimelech's last descendant dies. So where did people bring korbanot in these days? In these days, what you actually had was the Mishkan, that same tabernacle that they carried from place to place to place to place. The Mishkan was the central house of worship. But it was no longer carried from place to place, but it became established in a town that was known as Shiloh. Shiloh, of course, still exists. It's a West Bank settlement, and it has its share of controversy. But that is the house of the Mishkan, and it was there for the entire period of the Judges. So it was actually there for 300 years in Shiloh. And he would bring up his family to bring korbanot to God in Shiloh. And there we are told the two sons of Eli, who was the Kohen Gadol, Chafni u'Pinchas. Now remember, this is not the famous Pinchas. Don't confuse this. There is the Pinchas of the Chumash, who was the zealous grandson of Aaron, who avenged the fornication, etc. This Pinchas is kind of a bad guy. These are Eli's two sons. And let's say, Penina and the 10 kids are here, they all get their 10 portions. Chana has one portion, but because he loves her, he gives her a double portion. As if, somehow, more meat is going to resolve the heartbreak that she is feeling. But he says, here, I want to give you something more, because he loved Chana. Now, it does say, interestingly enough, it does not say the Lashon of Breishit, that he loved Rachel and, you know, despised Leah, whatever that means exactly. He does not say anything negative about Penina, but it said there was a special love for Chana. And he gave Chana more food, but God had closed her womb. Now look at verse 6. Verse 6 is a disturbing verse. Her tsara. Now tsara is an interesting word. Tsara is a co-wife. Interesting word, because the word tsara normally means adversity, trouble, problem. Well, the word for a co-wife is a tsara. And that's exactly it. A co-wife. In other words, if a man marries two women, each woman is called a tsara for the other woman. That's exactly the term. Sarot. And the reason is quite obvious, presumably, and that is bringing in multiple wives generates a lot of sarot for the wives, for each other, and towards the husband as well. Well, verse 6 says the following. Actually, let me explain something. Actually, there actually is a halachic reason why polygamy was sometimes considered to be actually a proper thing to do. It certainly was not the ideal, even when it was permitted, because the ideal is that a person should forsake, it says, his father and mother and cleave unto his wife and be one. And that's certainly a monogamous idea. But there is a halachic technical reason why polygamy was actually considered to be proper. And that is, let's assume that one married a woman and the woman is childless. Let's assume Chana was his first wife. Now, there is a mitzvah of being fruitful and multiplying. And in fact, in the Shulchan Aruch, there's actually a law which we do not follow today. I'll explain why. But there is a law that says if a man is married for 10 years, and is childless, and the reason, the diagnosis would be because of a female infertility. That would be the diagnosis. According to the halakha, I'll mention why we don't do this today, the man should divorce his wife and marry another woman because of the obligation to have children. Now, if you think about this, when polygamy was a permissible option, you actually had another way. Instead of divorcing and terminating marriage, there was the possibility of having another wife. Now, I don't know. I don't have a record of who was the first wife, but it could very well be. Just like Avraham took Hagar. In fact, the whole source is, Avraham lived in Israel for 10 years, then he took Hagar. Although Hagar was not a wife, but it was a similar way. But it could very well be. Maybe Chana was wife number one, and this was an option. Now, today, where polygamy is prohibited for Ashkenazic Jews, since the ban of Rabbeinu Gershom, it's a rabbi in Germany, which was promulgated in the 1100s. I'm sorry, the 11th century, the 1000s. So polygamy is no longer an option. If one were to follow the letter of the law, if there is female infertility, halacha would require a divorce, strictly speaking. Now, as a common practice, I just want to say, as a common practice, this is not advocated today, and this is usually not followed today, for a lot of reasons. The simple reason is that stated by the Rama, that husbands and wives are not fungible. You can't tell a person, get rid of this and find another one. Because the unique relationship that people have, you can't just say marry somebody else. It doesn't work that way. And therefore, as a practical matter, we do have shalom bayit, and we don't encourage this. Although I was told that the Lubavitcher Rebbe, did not have children. He wanted to fulfill this halakha literally. So he would give his wife a get every 10 years, and then marry her right after that. Kind of course, it wouldn't have worked if he'd be a Kohen. If a Kohen divorces his wife, he cannot take her back. So he wanted to fulfill the letter of the law, but at the same time keep the marriage. I'm sorry. Yeah. Yeah.
And the wife says to her husband that 10 years or more.
Yeah.
And he had 11 children, and the children used to visit that woman on a regular basis, but he never saw her. But he kept her and...
That's a very interesting story that shows you how, when this halacha was carried out, how it was. It wasn't in rejection, but somehow it was.
One of those children went to my brother-in-law.
It's a good, it's a very, very fascinating story. Yeah. Yeah, so this is an interesting idea. Adoption obviously is more practiced today than it was in ancient times. There is a teaching in the Gemara. Now, the Gemara says, Kol HaMagadel Yatom V'Yatama B'Toch Beitel. He who raises an orphaned boy or an orphaned girl in his house, is Ma'ale Alaf HaKatuv. The Torah considers it Ki'ilu Yaladel, as if you gave birth to them. That's a statement. So there is one authority that actually writes that a childless couple that adopts a child that needs a family actually fulfills the biblical commandment of being fruitful and multiplying through the process of adoption. However, I have to say that that is a dat yachid, that is not the consensus of the mainstream halakha. The mainstream halakha would say adoption is a great, great mitzvah and a great merit. not adoption per se, but to raise a child, to give a child a home is a great mitzvah, but it's not technically peru or avu until one has a biological child. So it would not be, it would be a good thing, but it wouldn't be exactly the same. Of course, halakha, by the way, does not recognize adoption, qua adoption. By that I mean, halakha recognized the concept of raising orphans, giving them a home, but halakha does not regard that as a severance of the connection to the biological parent. I'll give you an example. If I adopt a child, that child is still considered halakhically related to their biological parents. So when the biological parent dies, the child gets yerusha, he gets inheritance. Conversely, an adopted child does not automatically inherit from his adopted parent unless the adopted parent makes a will. It would not pass automatically because only the biological children are the biological heirs. That even means, strictly speaking, that when an adopted parent dies, there is no obligation on an adopted child to either sit Shiva or say Kaddish, although Kaddish would be strongly encouraged, because Kaddish is also a question of gratitude and love for someone. Sitting Shiva is more questionable, because Shiva really is limited to the biological connection. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I'm sorry. I was going to ask that an adopted son cannot become
Kohen. That's right. That's a big one. I'll tell you, this is a very, very big one, because, you know, I'm not a Kohen, so I don't know it firsthand, but I know that for a Kohen, a very, very significant concept is passing that on to your child. Duchening together, the reciting, the priestly blessing together, and the like. And I think the most important thing to recognize is that if I adopt a non-Jewish child and the child undergoes conversion, the child is Jewish, of course. If I adopt a Jewish child, the child is Jewish. But if I adopt a child who's either a non-Jew who converts or a child who's Jewish, and I'm a Kohen, that does not make the child a Kohen. And it may sound like a small thing, but I do know, I mean, I am aware of cases where a couple, the woman desperately wants to adopt, and the main emotional issue for the father is I can't have a child that I can't raise as a Kohen. And it sounds like it wouldn't be such a big issue, but it is a very, very significant issue for people.
That's right.
Really?
Okay. Then all right. If he's a Kohen, he's a Kohen. In fact, even if Israel adopts him, he's a Kohen, because it doesn't sever that relationship. So this is a very important issue. And in fact, I know in Israel a similar case of a Kohen who did adopt. And you know, in Israel, it's a little different. In Israel, they recite the priestly blessing every day, even in a regular daily service, at least in Jerusalem. And this son refuses to daven. He's already bar mitzvah. He refuses to daven in the same shul as his father. He says it's too embarrassing for him that his father gets up and duchen and he doesn't, and people are going to say, why are you duchening? And he has to say he's adopted, whatever it is. It's so noticeable that he, of course, in Yerushalayim, you know, there are hundreds of shuls all over the place. He just go next door, but it's an issue. He's uncomfortable davening with his father.
Using that logic, then the descendant should be from the mother, because you never know what the
That's true, but we have a halachic.
That's why
Judaism is matrilineal. But generally speaking, you should know. There's a general rule that halacha assumes that most of the relations a woman has will be with her husband, even if she is promiscuous. In fact, that's why it's very hard to have a mamzer. Basically, thank God. Meaning, theoretically, if a woman conceives a child out of adultery, that child is a mamzer. However, the halakhic assumption always is any child she had was from her husband. And there are poskim that even say this is true even with DNA testing. That halakha does not even enable DNA testing to prove to prove something detrimental. That DNA testing, that a person is a mamzer, that he's not from the father, or blood testing, whatever, are not halakhically sufficient to negate the paternity of the husband. So the truth of the matter is Mamzer is a tough halacha, but it's extremely difficult to establish that a child is a mamzer. Maybe if it's interracial, there might be those possibilities, right? Maybe. But they really bend over backwards to assume that a child is the cheskat kashrut, that he's in a status where there's no particular problem. But be it as it may, chapter 1 is the story where Elkanah tries to be a very supportive husband. And again, you know, infertility is an issue that people face today, right? We have all sorts of fancy technologies. We have egg donation and artificial insemination and surrogate motherhood and everything else. But the pain of infertility is a very, very real pain. It's a pain both for men and for women. But one could imagine that women feel it on some level, in a deeper level. And Elkanah is a supportive husband. I don't know what the modern term for that would be. Elkanah tells her, you know, aren't I good enough for you? Meaning, you know, you have me. So you don't have children. So what? I'm better for you than 10 children. It's interesting to compare this to another infertility scene that appears in the book of Bereshit, with Yaakov and Rachel, where Yaakov is not necessarily as understanding at first glance. When Rachel goes to Yaakov and said, "If I pray for me that I may have children, because if I cannot have children, I don't want to live, I want to die." And Yaakov says to her, "Hatachas Elokim Anochi. Am I in the place of God?" Then he turns the blade a little bit. Asher mana mimech pribata. He has withheld from you children. Meaning, I don't have a problem. I have other wives. I have other kids. You got a problem. So what do you want from me? And the Medrash actually comments with some astonishment on Yaakov's answer. Kach onin et hameikot? Is this how you answer somebody in pain? The Medrash is a bit astonished. Elkanah, on the other hand, is ineffectual, we would say. In other words, what he says doesn't work, but his heart seems to be in the right place. He basically says, "You got a good marriage. I'm a good husband. We love each other. So you don't have children. Something missing, but we have each other." But the truth is, there's a beautiful explanation from one of the medieval commentators. This is a sefer, a very interesting name. It's called Akedat Yitzchak, but it doesn't mean the sefer. Well, it's borrowed from the sefer, but this was authored by Rav Yitzchak Arama, who was a great medieval philosopher. And the Akedah, as he's called, the Baal HaAkedah, the author of the Akedah. And this is really, it's not studied that much today because that particular philosophical genre is found less favor. People like quicker explanations. You'll go out for, you know, 50 or 60 page essays on things. But he offers this explanation in Yaakov, and he says the following. Yaakov is indeed answering very angrily, and he's very upset. But he says the key reason why Yaakov is upset is because she was demeaning the validity, kind of a modernist idea, the validity of her life as a woman. Because what she was saying is, if I can't have children, I might as well be dead. And that hurts Yaakov tremendously. Because what she is saying is, there is no value in her life, and there is no value in her marriage other than the children that she produces. So indeed, Yaakov's answer seems to be inappropriate, and Yaakov's answer is angry and rejecting, but he suggests it's a rejection that ultimately comes from his love and respect for her, because his response is, your life has value apart from this. Our marriage has value apart from this. So in a sense, Yaakov's anger comes from the hurts that her remark says about her and about them. So this is not to say it was the right way to say it, but he says, but from a deeper perspective, it emanates from love. It does not emanate from disdain. And this is how he understands it. So, but Elkanah kind of tries to say, well, you know, aren't I good enough? And there is no answer that is recorded. You know, Elkanah says, kind of says neither yes or no. She just gets up and walks away, kind of. You know, as if to say, men, you know, they just don't understand. Okay. So, anyway, but what she does is, she now enters the sanctuary. Because remember the way it was. The karban was brought in the sanctuary, but then people would eat in the city. They would eat around the area. She leaves the family, she leaves the group, she leaves Penina with the 10 kids, who are probably, you know, rambunctious and playing and laughing. She leaves her husband, and she enters the sanctuary in Shiloh. And she starts praying. And it mentions that Eli, the high priest, who was this day, very day, became a shofet, is sitting, meaning he's just sitting, whatever he's doing. He doesn't say what he's doing, but he's sitting down. And she doesn't seem to notice that he's there. And she enters. You know, there are many scenes in Eastern Europe, it was very common for women to often go to the synagogue at night, midnight, and they would open up the ark, and they would cry, as it were, into the Aron HaKodesh. It was there. And this is probably borrowed from what Chana does. She enters the tabernacle when nobody is there. She thinks nobody's there. And because of the bitterness of her soul, she prays to God. And it's interesting, I think I have to stop soon, but it's interesting that all of the laws about how we daven the Shemona Esrei, the Amidah, are derived from Chana's prayer. The lips moving and no sound emerges. All of this comes from Chana. And she cries, and she cries to God. And of course, crying is a very significant thing. It is said that all the gates in heaven are closed, except the gates of tears. That the prayers that one can offer to God with the sincere tears of the heart, they break down all barriers. Which is why I once saw this rhetorical question. It says, if we would see somebody break down and cry during an Amidah, we would think they were mentally deranged, probably. It's so foreign to our experience of everyday prayer that we think it's bizarre, when in fact, on some level, it is the highest form of prayer that one can have, that one is so emotionally connected in their yearning to God that their tears come out spontaneously. Okay, that's a very, very high level of prayer. And she cries to God. But she makes a bet with God. She makes a neder, a vow. And she says, if you will remember me, and you will give me a child. It's interesting. The child that she asks for, it's very interesting, is Zera Anashim, a seed of people. What do you mean a seed of people? God's not going to give her an animal. So there are two interpretations in the Midrash. Listen to these two interpretations. One interpretation is, may he be a man among men. She's praying for an exceptional person, a person with qualities of righteousness and leadership. Now that we understand, you're praying to God for. But there's another interpretation, that a man among men means, God, I want somebody average. I want somebody who doesn't stick out. I want somebody who will not be too conspicuous. That is a strange prayer that she's saying, because exceptionality has its costs. Sometimes, you know, we talk about special needs children on one side of the spectrum, and then you have people who are unusual, even in what you might call good ways, can sometimes create a lot of dysfunction and tragedy. She says, I want my son to be a person who fits in the world. And indeed, we're going to see that it's as if the prophet, the book makes a point that in spite of the fact that Shmuel, in effect, Chana got both, that's what I'm saying. In other words, Chana got a son who was exceptional in his saintliness and righteousness. But she also got a person, and it says very, very specifically, that he not only walked with God, but he walked with man. There is a point that Shmuel was a person who you got along with, who interacted with people, who was friendly, who did not, as it were, separate himself from the masses. So in effect, these two interpretations, I want an average person, and I want a special person. She got a... Huh? This is Pasuk Vav. The word Zera Anashim is a seed of person. Oh, I'm sorry, Pasuk Yudav, I'm sorry, Pasuk Yudav. Right? But she prays, and of course, well, Zera Anashim. Pasuk Yudav, Zera Anashim. And then she says another thing, and she says, if you give me such a child, I will give him to God all of his life. Now, the term giving a child to God is not entirely clear. What institution is that? According to one interpretation, she consecrated Shmuel to be a Nazir, just like Shimshon. According to the other interpretation, it simply means that she would dedicate him to service in the sanctuary. Now, he was not a Kohen, so he could actually not do the Korbanot. According to tradition, he was a Levi, and he kind of assisted it, and he became an assistant. Now, we will see that as a young child, she kind of relinquished custody, and he was raised by Eli, the high priest. And then it says, Umara, this is the verse 11, the end of it, Umara lo yale al rosho. Now, this is an interesting term, mora. What does mora mean? There are two translations. With an aleph, the word mora normally means fear. Fear shall never go upon him, meaning to say he should be a fearless, courageous person. That she identifies the quality of courage as a quality that she wants. We don't mean courage in being a daredevil, but courage in standing up for what's right, even if other people downgrade it. There's another translation that Morah means a razor, and this would confirm the interpretation that she was taking a vow of Nazir. A razor shall never alight upon a son. Yeah, so this is one of the questions. Shimshon, of course, is not a precedent because God made Shimshon a Nazir. The Mishnah says in Tractate Nazir that a father has the authority to impose Nazirut on a child. Of course, the mother may not. And then the question is, well, what's Chana doing if that's so? And according to one interpretation, she made the promise, but then she would have to convince her husband to go along with the promise. Okay, we'll stop here. We'll have to continue next week. But I just want to say that the story goes on, as you know, that Eli sees this woman moving her lips and thinks she must be drunk because she's talking to herself and no words are coming out. And she corrects him in saying that I am praying to God. Eli gives her a bracha. And a year later, she does give birth. Rosh Hashanah, she conceives. A year, according to the story, this encounter happened on Shavuot. She conceived on Rosh Hashanah, and Shmuel was born on Shavuot. So actually, it was not a nine-month pregnancy, it was a little less than that. And Shmuel was born 1 year from Chana's prayer. Okay, and for Rosh Hashanah, Chana was given the blessing of fertility. We are also told, although we're not given their names, that Chana had other children after that, sons and daughters, although not as much as Penina. And a final thing just to think about is, this notion of Penina taunting her is very problematic. Because Penina used to taunt her to make her upset. What type of story is that? So the Gemara says in Tractate Bava Batra, an interpretation, that Penina's intention was for the sake of heaven. Because she wanted to provoke Chana into praying to God. Because the alternative would have been that Chana would have accepted her situation, don't complain, get used to it, and she wouldn't have turned to God in prayer. And this raises one of perhaps the most difficult theological questions. The Talmud does say that the reason why the matriarchs were barren is because God desired them to pray. God created a situation that would force them to pray. Now think about what that means. We often think that I pray because I have difficulties in my life. It's the opposite. The real need is to pray. God gives us difficulties, so we will turn to Him in prayer. Otherwise, we would not know we have a need. Just like pain. Pain physiologically serves a very, very useful function. If the body would not have pain, you would not have awareness of what needs to be corrected. Pain is an alarm system. So people who have nerve damage or whatever are often not aware. Their head could be in a fire and they don't know it. Right? So pain is our warning system. So the real need of a person is prayer. Prayer is what you need. But without pain, we're not aware of our need. Prayer makes us aware. And therefore it's the opposite. In fact, there's a famous thought that, you know, the snake was cursed, that the snake has to eat dirt. So the question is, what's so bad about dirt? If that's what you eat, it's always available. And the answer is, the curse of the snake is, the snake will never have a need which will force it to turn to God. The snake has no need to go into God's presence. And the example is, let's imagine there's someone collecting for money, you want to get rid of them. So sometimes, you know, there are a lot of people, you might want to tell your secretary, just give them what they want, get them out of here. And I don't want a relationship, God says. Give him what he wants and get him out of my presence. God allows there to be needs, so we turn to him in prayer and form that relationship. Now this raises a very, very difficult question, exactly. Because on one hand, a Jew believes, and I'll leave you with this difficult question to grapple with, that everything God does is for the good. Gamzu l'tova. God gives and God takes. May the name of God be blessed. We are told to accept what happens to us because this is God's will and we're not supposed to complain. And yet, we are told that God made people barren and God allows sorrow to happen precisely so that we storm the gates of heaven and protest and fight and try to have things changed. So the question becomes, what's the balance? I mean, let's take even infertility as the example. When is the point in which you say, this is God's will, I accept and I will build a life of meaning and purpose even without the blessing of biological children. When do you say that? And when do you say, no, God has given me a test, so I will surmount this test by prayer? It's a hard question, because we're seeing both voices in this tradition, and they really work in opposite ways. One idea is quiescent acceptance of God's ways as just, and the other is God is creating the situation so that you will pray. Okay, so we'll talk about this next week, but something to think about.